almost to the weekend. It's me, Anna DeVlantis, here on WGN. We're still looking for the sun. Still looking for it. Over a week now, I think you guys have been pointing out that we have not seen the sun. But I guess the good news coming from WGN-TV is that the Weather Center over there is that we're supposed to see it Sunday and Monday quite prominently. So we got that to look forward to. I'm ready. I need some vitamin D, you know? Kind of there. Totally there. A couple of things that we need to get to and then more about what's coming up on the show today, including the governor calling for clearing out corruption in Springfield, something we've heard many times before. Is this time real? We're going to hear from Amanda Vinicky from WTTW. She was down there, got some reaction, including some lawmakers saying, well, even the plans we've got now don't even go far enough. We've got much farther we need to go in the state, but we'll get to that. I want to ask you this. Remember where you were last year on this day?
Where was I?
Well, this will help you jog your memory.
Okay.
Here's some words. Siberia. Polar vortex. It's the polar vortex versary. 1 year ago today, the coldest of the cold air swept through the Chicago area. We all remember that.
But
how can you forget?
Was there sun that day?
You know, I can't imagine with a negative 23 degree real temperature, but honestly don't remember that part because I think I went out for exactly 3 minutes. I had to walk the dog because if you're a dog owner, the dog still has to go somewhere unless you train him on those little pee-pee pads. And my dog is not trained to do that. Took the dog out. And I remember just thinking I was in a Will Smith movie because it was like haunting. Remember that?
When it's that cold, it's just your entire everything on your face freezes. Like your nostrils freeze, your eyes freeze. It's just everything is frozen.
I remember being just covering up all the way to your eyeballs and still wasn't enough somehow. Wasn't enough. We all remember that. So it's kind of good to know. Rockford, by the way, hit negative 31 on this day 1 year ago. And that's real temperature, right? So think about that with the windshield factor. Remember that. We were just... It was the coldest place on earth, it felt like.
Would you rather have one really cold day, like Siberia, or 9 straight days of no sunshine?
That's a tough one. That Siberia was rough, though.
Just
even
one
for
day.
A hearty Chicagoan, I don't know. I think the sun's coming out still, and I it's going to be this weekend. So Super Bowl Sunday, watch for the sun. It is nearly 60 degrees warmer today than 1 year ago. So it makes you feel kind of warm, doesn't it?
Oh, well, then that's a positive outlook.
There you go. See?
I appreciate that.
Yeah, I need that. So that there you go. That's something to hang on to today. You know, I know James Sears is in the news department today, doing the news for us right now, as Steve Bertrand just stepped out for a little bit. And I heard you talk about there's this Chicago woman who had the coronavirus. We heard that big news conference about that a little over a week ago. And now it's been confirmed that she has infected her husband. And I know I heard Steve mention earlier that wasn't entirely unexpected, that they obviously had close contact, but that this is the first person-to-person spread of coronavirus in the United States.
Right. The incubation period is between 7 and 10 days for once you get the virus for symptoms to show. So officials have been watching this person, and today we got word. Right now there is a press conference going on right now, and we are monitoring it.
Oh.
So we'll have an update for you in our next newscast. But yeah, he's in the hospital in stable condition, but he does have coronavirus, the second case in Illinois.
Yeah, I remember at the time I listened closely to the last news conference, and they said that she really didn't have contact with all that many people. She didn't go on public transportation. She didn't have a party. She didn't have people over, anything like that. Clearly, her husband was someone she was going to be in contact with. And I think that's why the health officials saying, hey, this is not entirely unexpected. It's just the first human to human, because she traveled to Wuhan, China, I remember, to tend to a sick parent, a dad, her dad, I think. But her husband did not go. So he was here, never had any contact with that province, obviously had contact with her.
Obviously unintentional, but could you imagine being the person that brings it to the state or to the city? I mean, you just hope. I mean, that they contain it.
I think health officials seem to have a pretty good handle on this one.
Can you imagine if you were the person?
No, you would not want to be that person.
No.
I saw Gwyneth Paltrow in that movie. It didn't work out well. But the nice part is what the health officials saying, this is contained. This is not something to worry about. And remember, the flu is pretty big right now. I know a lot of people being impacted personally by the flu, gone through my daughter's school.
People die from the flu.
and it's much, your chances of getting the flu far, far greater than
Very good to put it into context there.
Let's keep things in perspective, right?
We should
do that. Okay, I'm getting ready for my Super Bowl cooking. I love to cook, and we have a lot of people over for the big fat Greek and Italian family. And I always do the two chilies. I do the veggie chili, and then I do the ground beef chili. And I hate the chopping part, but I love making the chilies.
You don't get much of a break because you just had everybody over for the holidays.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of family get-togethers, and then it just sort of grows from there. But I do enjoy the cooking part of it. Favorite Super Bowl foods. What do you look forward to? What do you have to have at your Super Bowl party?
Oh, I love those little loaded baked potatoes, mm-hmm. And jalapeno poppers. Oh, chicken wings.
Jalapeno poppers is number 10 on the list of most popular.
It has to be chicken wings.
Chicken wings, I think, is number one. Let me get over there. Nachos, number three. Pizza, number two. Chicken wings, number mm-hmm. one. You kind of have to have them, right?
You really do.
I had a Super Bowl party one year and I forgot about them. I'd be like, where are the wings? Where are the wings? Like, oh, you got to have them. You got to have wings.
My favorite wing in the city is called Landbirds. Landbirds. There's one in Logan Square. It's like a Korean style. Mm. Crispy, a little sweet, a little hot, spicy. Frenched chicken wing. It's so delicious.
Mm-hmm.
It's addictive.
Do you do the guacamole and the salsa late in the party, or do you sort of stay away from it? You know how late in the party when it sort of gets the big, hole in it and all the little kids have put their hands in it?
No. I like to do it early on and then just scoop out the problem is I will scoop out a huge portion and just put it on my plate, which is not very polite. But I just assume you're going to have vats of guacamole to continually refill the guac.
The replenishment. Then you jump in there. Jump right in there. That's what I do. That's just a pro tip for Super Bowl parties. But I'm excited about the Super Bowl weekend. And listen to this, 773, we were talking about the polar vortex this day last year, the coldest day of that polar vortex stretch. Last year, I was on the balcony of a cruise ship overlooking Key West during the polar vortex, Wally the Trucker. Thanks, Wally. Thanks for weighing in on that. I remember those people posting on social media, and I was so jealous and kind of angry about it.
Well,
remember that?
Listen to the 630. I remember where I was 1 year ago today. My wife and I woke up in Hawaii for our vacation. Good timing. Oh, yes. 630. Brilliant. I wish I were in Hawaii.
That was a well-timed vacation to both of you. Thank you for sharing. And now I don't mind hearing it now. I did.
Yes, because it was so cold.
It was horrifying.
But I would, I'm still looking for that sun.
Yes. It's coming. It is coming. Sunday, Monday, look for the sun in Chicago.
We need that song. Here comes the sun.
Coming up here on the show, we've got some sunshine out of Springfield, we think, and it's with Amanda Vinicky from WTTW. She was down there covering the calls for a cleanup of all the corruption in state government. That was the highlight of the governor's State of the State address. And all I could think about when I heard it is, we have heard this before, right? We've totally heard this before. Anything different this time? We'll find out. We'll also get reaction. Amanda Vinicky checks in with us next. 1:17 coming up on here on WGN. This is Anna DeVlantis, and I want to get to what happened in Springfield yesterday. The governor, Governor Pritzker, gave his State of the State address, and generally, it was an upbeat address. He outlined some initiatives moving forward, setting the tone in Springfield for what's ahead in the legislative session and beyond. Quality education, high up there, affordable health care, working on that, helping seniors, some plans in the works for that, the progressive income tax, we'll get to that too, and then infrastructure spends. That was on the agenda, but it really felt as if the headline was, and the focus on the need to clean up Springfield and clean up corruption, that sort of set the tone for what's coming in Springfield. And I wonder how it was received, and find out more about what the governor said. WTTW's Amanda Vinicky. She was down there covering it. And we appreciate you checking in with the show, Amanda. How are you?
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
Have you driven back now? Are you back in the city?
I am in route, not quite in the city. I'm in the suburbs right now. So, saying hi, I think, from Willowbrook.
Making that trek back and forth to Springfield. It's lovely. I know. I've done it myself. Anyway, I want to ask you about how this was received. Kind of give us a little bit of your take on the reception of the governor's talk about corruption. And we have a soundbite here so people can listen in a little bit of what he had to say. This is Governor Pritzker.
It's no longer enough to sit idle while under-the-table deals, extortion, or bribery persist. Protecting that culture or tolerating it is no longer acceptable. We must take urgent action to restore the public's trust in our government. That's why we need to pass real, lasting ethics reform this legislative session.
All right, a lot of applause there. J.B. Pritzker speaking about passing ethics reform legislation. Are those just applause, or you really think that's something that could get done? Amanda, what do you think?
Ooh, something has to get done, for sure. There is no way that a legislator, particularly in an election year, can ask voters to say, hey, send me back to Springfield, unless they get something done on the election front. And Governor J.B. Pritzker needs to do something, too. The issue being several fronts. First of all, a lot of what you see these legislators being charged with right now, we have, of course, just this week with just resigned State Senator Martin Sandoval pleading guilty. So the first actual consequence and kind of completion of all of this investigation. But part of it is what they were doing. I mean, bribery is already illegal.
Right.
You don't need a new law to pass that. So there's that. And then the second thing is just how much teeth will be in anything that does, in fact, get passed. So, for example, Governor Pritzker, really for the first time, coming out with some concrete ideas of what he would back. And what he's talking about is closing this revolving door that means that you can be a legislator, a member of the General Assembly, say on Friday, resign on Saturday, and then Monday start being a lobbyist and going back and asking your colleagues for vote, your just former colleagues. There's that. He also has talked about more disclosure of financial interests and conflicts of interest, therefore, that we right now don't know what legislators could be voting on. So, for example, you have a former representative, he resigned as well, Luis Arroyo, who evidently had been working as a lobbyist for the video gambling industry, even as he was proposing voting on and holding and chairing committee hearings on video gaming operations. And then also the governor talked about banning lawmakers, so like I said, from being lobbyists as well at the same time, and other elected officials from simultaneously holding down lobbying gigs. Some of that sounds like it should be easy enough, but really it does get difficult. How much of their financial information do legislators want to share so that their neighbors can read it, their in-laws, their future opponents on the campaign trail? You have some female legislators in particular pushing back and saying, hey, Springfield's had this boys club for a really long time where we have watched legislators walk through that revolving door or circle through it, I guess I should say, and get lobbying gigs. Why, now that there are more of us, why can't we? What, you're cutting off that spigot now when this is our area of expertise? So really, you had Governor Pritzker be so successful his first year in getting his agenda through. Some of this might be more difficult.
Yeah, you get that feeling. I mean, you've seen for so long, you know, many of us sort of just citizens scratching our head when you hear, okay, you get a seat at the table to vote on something that you personally profit from, or your friends and family members profit from. It seems like that doesn't seem right in a lot of ways. That doesn't seem right at all. And then you feel like what you just mentioned, that if you're going to leave one day, then 24 hours later start as a lobbyist for something you had power and influence over, that maybe, I guess the suggestion is there should at least be a cooling off period, a period of time where you couldn't actually serve as a lobbyist for that sort of thing. These are the kinds of issues they're looking at, and you outlined it so well. It makes sense that they're looking at it, and I understand that there's some sort of an ethics panel that either the governor is about to assemble or has it already been assembled in terms of next steps, where we go from here.
It has already been assembled. In fact, there was a meeting this morning. I listened to some of it. They're not going to have any votes or put forward a concrete plan just yet. They're still going to hold some more meetings, and then this commission, which is bipartisan and bicameral, will present a report with some recommendations. And that is presumably where we will see whatever legislation is introduced come out of. But again, is it enough? You have, in particular, Republicans who don't run the show. They are saying, hey, wait a second, you don't want to talk about some of the ethics matters that aren't particularly within the jurisdiction of this commission, you know, when they passed it. And further, we don't need to wait. Some of this stuff should be easy. For example, the financial interest, conflict of interest statement that I had mentioned. Mm-hmm. Republicans have been introducing a plan for years, and not just Republicans, there are legislators on both sides of the aisle that have long had bills ready and in the hopper. And so, again, there are some folks who I think everyone realizes that something has to happen. The big question and what we're going to be watching is just how strong is it? And I'll add also part of this is a cultural shift and even maybe who we're electing, local voters holding their officials responsible. There was a comment that a House Republican leader, Jim Durkin, made the other day about Martin Sandoval. He said, well, everybody knew that he was a shady guy. I'm not sure that Sandoval's allies would appreciate that characterization, but let me tell you, Durkin isn't the first to have had that sort of suggestion about Sandoval. So what does that say? That he was evidently, you know, had this sort of reputation as a guy who operated around the edges of ethical behavior, but he continually not only was sent back to Springfield, but amassed more power.
Well, and it's interesting because this federal probe that is still underway may help the governor if he's true in trying to create an ethics reform that's real. Because if you start going in and looking at so many lawmakers and see who's connected to Martin Sandoval, even though he was around for a long time, and some people, as Durkin pointed out, would call him shady or whatever you however you want to characterize him. Again, he wouldn't like that. But you start thinking of the connectivity of so many lawmakers around him for so many years, and you wonder how many of them may also be facing some questions from the feds. I think it's fascinating. You know, the clip we just played, Amanda, from the governor, when everybody stood up and applauded, I was reading, but you were there. I was reading that even Mike Madigan stood up and applauded that. Now, he's been around for a while. He's had several opportunities to pass ethics reform, and he certainly is somebody who had the power to do it. That's the kind of stuff that makes me sort of nervous that this won't happen.
You know, he issued a statement. We haven't actually had an interview with Madigan, not just me, but the press corps in general. He has not been in public view really since any of this corruption stuff came out, save for answering during the veto session, literally like 1 or 2 minutes of questions from journalists, at which point in time he said that to his knowledge, he was not under any sort of federal investigation. All we got from him yesterday was a statement in which he called for an end to bad behavior. But in that statement, he did not specifically address any of the proposals that Pritzker had laid out during his State of the State address. And Madigan took pains to, in that statement, point out what I had mentioned, and that is that you'll have bad actors who have chosen to break already existing law. And Madigan, in his statement, said, no law is going to change that. If there's somebody that is going to want to be unethical, operate in an illegal capacity, they can do so no matter what action the General Assembly takes.
I guess, but you can also be better at reporting it, too. I mean, is one of his closest allies, Mike McClain, the longtime lobbyist and man who's been around for half a century there in Springfield, very powerful man, I think most would agree. He is under the scrutiny of the federal corruption investigation himself, close ties to Mike Madigan. So you wonder, it's like, if you guys know about some of this stuff and those things don't feel right, it feels as if there could be a little more, not only policing of it, but reporting it voluntarily so that we preserve this kind of ethics everyone says they'd like to project. Let me ask you about something else, though, Amanda, before we run out of time here, because the graduated income tax, I know, is top on the governor's agenda. Not going to be an easy sell, but I know that there's been a lot of momentum and a lot of talk about it now for some time. Is that on the, when will that be coming up, and when will we likely see any kind of movement on the graduated rate income tax?
So the governor has basically funded a separate organization that will be campaigning for this, because he needs to be really careful about how much of government time and money, taxpayer money, is spent advocating for this question. So he's basically self-funding a separate organization to do that. And I just saw that they are looking for a video editor and social media guru. So I think that is a sign that we are going to very soon be inundated on, you know, whether you are on Twitter or whether you are on Instagram, you are going to be inundated soon with online ads. We're sort of waiting for the commercial TV and radio to drop, but this is going to be huge. We didn't actually hear a ton of it about that from Governor Pritzker yesterday. I think part of that is because he's got his budget address coming up in 3 weeks, and also because he needs to be careful as his critics are going to be watching just how much, like I mentioned, of state time he's going to be campaigning on this issue, so he's got to be careful there. But, well, you know, we are all going to be so sick of it, but hopefully informed so that come election time, people will be able to decide and to discern the facts from fiction and what they really believe should be part of the Constitution as they decide whether lawmakers should be empowered to charge income tax rates at different levels based on how much money you make, what sort of income bracket you fit in versus a flat rate for everyone.
The facts will be important, you're right, for everyone to have. Is it, to remind us all, though, will there be a referendum on the ballot? Is that the first step, one of the steps that are coming up here? Tell us what happens.
So, yeah, that's really the main step at this point in time. You already had legislators pass language to put on the 2020 ballot. This will be the general election, so we're looking at November, not quite March, and maybe we will wait, like I said, to see all of those commercials until after the primary, because right now that's the focus of for everyone. But you're going to have a question actually on the ballot, and it's kind of confusing wording, but that's the bulk of it. Are you going to amend the Constitution to allow for income taxes to be at graduated rates versus one flat rate? The critics say that this is handing a blank paycheck over to legislators, and that right now you actually have some income brackets and the matching tax rates to go with them, and that's what it would be the case, but that's not going to be enshrined in the Constitution. Yeah. So critics say, hey, if you give lawmakers the authority right now, it protects what the middle happens? Class, but just wait. They're going to change that down the road. Yep. Democrats say, no, what this does is allows us to charge the wealthy more, to expect them to give back more into government coffers, pay their fair share. And Pritzker is saying, hey, I'm one of the wealthiest. This is me too. I will be paying more taxes. So believe me.
We'll watch for that, the referendum and the ad blitz coming to us all very soon. Amanda Vinicky, you always do such a great job for us. Thank you so much. WTTW is where you can find her, and she covers Springfield and politics and does it all very, very well. Thank you for weighing in here on WGN. Anna DeVlantz is here in the WGN studio. It's 1:33. Thanks for listening. We've talked recently a bit about recycling in the city. I've had several aldermen in, Alderman Wagasback, Alderman Riley. They've come in and just kind of shaken their heads and say, we just are not doing a good job in Chicago. It's actually there's some issues across the state as well. And Michelle Toma is with the Chicago Recycling Commission. Michelle, thanks for being in studio with us to try to help us understand what's going on here. We appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And you are a nonprofit. You don't just deal with Chicago. You deal with the efforts across the entire state of Illinois. Is that right?
We do, yes. And I mean, you know, recycling doesn't really have boundaries as much as we like to try to have them as human beings. And so we are... you know, we recognize issues with NIMBYism, you know, not in my backyard, and we don't want these issues in anyone's backyard. So our work does expand beyond Chicago.
What would you say is the number one concern about recycling? Why things are not going so well or as well as people would hope?
Here in Chicago, the real issue is we don't have the information. So you referenced the dismal recycling rates here in Chicago. The reality is, we really don't know what the recycling rates are.
They say it's 9%. I don't know if that means 9% of the available recyclables are actually recycled.
Right.
But you'd say it's lower than that.
I do, yeah. The Chicago City of Chicago hasn't reported recycling rates since July 2018. So, and we've asked for that information repeatedly. We've filed Freedom of Information requests for that information and have not received it. So, you know, we not having that information, we're skeptical as to whether we're even reaching 9%.
So one of the proposals is from the city of Chicago, at least, and you can speak to, I know you deal with the suburbs, you deal with all across the state, different types of recycling rates. And I imagine they're better in some areas than others.
Sure.
People are doing, where would you say is a good area? Where are they doing the best job? Just top of your mind. in terms of a pretty good job with recycling?
Well, I can't think of any place in the state of Illinois.
Because it's that bad or because you just off the top of your mind can't think of it?
We don't really have the information a lot of smaller municipalities, so I just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But the West Coast does a far better job. Even New York City has, is at 17%.
17?
Yeah.
Mm, that's much better than we are doing. All right, so what the city is proposing, at least here in Chicago, this council is considering this effort to say, hey, let's do, they've got the city's flat collection fee, which is based on weight. They want to take a close look at replacing that. They say that's not the way to do it. Tell us what's proposed. What would they like to do?
You're talking about the pay-as-you-throw?
Yeah, the city of Chicago's plan, at least. They haven't passed it, but the plan, they think might help solve it.
It might. There are a lot of areas of the country where there are pay-as-you-throw, especially in rural areas. You know, a lot of rural areas don't have pickup like we do here in Chicago. And so that plan hasn't been completely vetted at this point. So some ideas, though, are to have people be able to choose the size of their trash containers and pay a flat fee for the size of their trash container.
Mm-hmm.
And so the goal would be to get people to use smaller containers and so they can pay less. So there could be a cost savings to people. And then the people who are not recycling, who are not composting, would pay their fair share.
I see. So right now, I remember a couple of years ago, they tacked on nearly a $10 a month bill, or fee, I should say, to your water bill here in the city. It was a number of fees, a number of taxes that went up at that particular time and that stretch, and it was particularly painful. But I remember when that happened, we thought, okay, this will kind of help everything happen. Then there was that investigation that showed that some of the companies that were tasked with handling our recyclables, if they found one piece of contaminated anything, you see a pizza box that still has grease in it or the tiniest little piece of cheese stuck to the cardboard in there, they could rule that entire container as contaminated and they no longer would have to recycle it. They could then say, this is up to you, city. This goes into the waste, the general waste area, and we're just going to handle recycle. But they got paid per pound to recycle. It felt like the whole incentive of the system, the whole system really was a failure.
Right.
They
got paid to handle the recycling, and one of the recycling haulers also is a very large trash hauler. And so what was also found in the Better Government Association article you're referencing is that they were actually being paid twice for having the contents of some of those blue carts that they labeled as contaminated being dumped into landfills that they owned. So
that's going to change.
It does. And another piece of that is, so you're referring to the blue cart program, which is the managed competition that former Mayor Emanuel put into place. And that's another one of the issues and another area where we're really lacking information. It was characterized as a managed competition. The criteria for that competition was never disclosed. And so we don't know, like, what does success look like under this managed competition? What are these different haulers being judged on? And so it's DSS, the city of Chicago, is handling part of the blue carts, as well as two private haulers. And so what we see is also blue carts are being managed very differently among those three haulers. Mm-hmm. So there is the one that we talked about who was labeling a lot of blue carts disproportionately in comparison to the other
two
haulers.
Right. There was one more guilty than the others. It felt it was sort of abusing the system if you looked at that investigation and the amount that they were reporting contaminated versus as the others. But it seems like the whole system, the whole thing isn't working top to bottom. Another thing I hear from residents is that they say, hey, you know what? I just carefully took my recyclables and I put them in a little separate container and I did everything I'm supposed to do. But then they see the trash collection pick them up and they all go into the same place.
Yeah.
And they're like, are you really recycling that? Is that really happening?
Yeah. And I heard Alderman Riley talk about that yesterday.
He did.
And that's illegal. So that is not happening, as far as I know, under the blue cart program, but for private haulers who service the 5+ residential units and commercial units, which is required by law here in the city of Chicago, all buildings have to have a recycling program available.
If you have five or more units, then you have to set up your own private
right.
situation, because the city's not going to handle it for you
Correct.
For buildings that are five units and larger.
Right, right. And so that's illegal. It's the ordinance, the Chicago Recycling Ordinance, clearly states that haulers must keep recycling separate. So, and that's another issue that we see, is the city of Chicago hasn't been enforcing the law. And so I think the haulers and building owners know that they don't have to comply. There is an incentive, we believe, here at the Chicago Recycling Coalition to comply, because these are impacting all the environmental issues and the economic issues too are impacting all of us. But if a landowner or a building owner or the hauler can save some money,
What would you like to see? I mean, how can we all do better? If you were saying, hey, this is, if even well-intentioned people, I think, feel as if, you're trying to do what's right, and it's not always that easy to do, or you're making some mistakes in the process.
Yeah, well, I'm encouraged by Mayor Lightfoot's call for research to be done and to look into how we can improve our waste management practices generally. And I do think it is, even though at Chicago Recycling Coalition, our middle name is Recycling, we really advocate for recycling as kind of the second to last thing you do before dumping something in a landfill. So we really want to see people reducing where they can and reusing and composting. So I'm encouraged by Alderman Wagasback's introduction of the plastic free water ordinance.
He's trying to ban the containers for the restaurants and you sort of say poly, like the styrofoam.
Polystyrene. Yeah.
Polystyrene.
It's happened in Europe. It's happened in other places in the world. And so it's going to come one way or another. And I'm really excited that Alderman Wagasback is seeing this and taking the lead on this.
Gee, I know a lot of small mom and pop restaurants have said that this is going to be an expense for them and that's going to fall mostly on them, not the large chains who this kind of a smaller expense may not mean as much for. So I understand that concern. I think the headline that maybe caught a lot of us who weren't already sort of following environmental issues as well as maybe we should have been, when we heard about the plastics, the microplastics in our lake.
Right.
When that study came out that showed 22 million pounds of microplastics were in our lake, and that makes its way into water and everything, our fish, and they fish eat it, and the whole sort of ecosystem is being polluted by those. I think that's a bit of a wake up call.
Absolutely, and that's why the ordinance does address the issues that are being raised for restaurants, and Alderman Wagasback has been very clear that he wants to work with the restaurants to come up with a solution that's going to work for them as well. And as you pointed out, we are drinking, we are eating, and we are breathing plastics every single day. This has been scientifically proven at this point. And do we really want to be feeding this to our children and our grandchildren and wait to see what happens? I don't think so. I don't know anybody who would say yes, that's okay.
I think the answer to that might be no.
Yeah.
A lot to follow, and thank you for bringing us up speed on what's going on. I had a lot of questions before, and the alderman didn't necessarily have everything you had, and I thought, well, let's see if Michelle Toma from the Chicago Recycling Commission can tell us more. So thanks for making time for us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Good to see you. Dr. Willie Wilson is stepping into the PPG Paints Green Room, and he's going to talk to us more. So I've got some things about politics and an initiative he's working on that he wants to tell you why it's the thing, and city council isn't even sold yet, but he's going to sell you and tell you why it should happen. Coming up here on WGN 146 here on WGN Radio 720, where Dr. Willie Wilson has stepped into the studio. We were seeing you a lot when you were running for mayor not all that long ago. Good to see you, Willie.
Well, good to see you also.
Yeah, so you're running for something now, too, aren't you? You are running for Senate as an independent?
Well, as independent. Mine doesn't start until March the 20th,
yeah,
I think,
so in
the petition, yeah.
You run for a number of things. I want you to weigh in about politics, but we're going to get to that. Because you actually even went to the Iowa caucuses, didn't you, when you were...
Yes, we sure did.
Sure did.
Uh-huh.
We've talked about you being an incredible business success story. We've talked about your various runs for office. But now you wanted to come in to talk about the Chicago reparations movement.
That's correct. And also, well, at the state.
As the state, as well as the city. So you're kind of lobbying on both fronts to get some sort of reparations. And I want to drill down on this about what you want to do, because it feels as if people hear the word reparations, and I think it means different things to different people.
Yes.
And one of the things you often hear is that it means that, you find people who are descendants of slaves,
mm-hmm.
and presumably there's some sort of proof of that, and then mm-hmm. you pay them a certain amount of money for, among other things, civil wrongs and things that their work their ancestors did in the past.
That's correct, but it's more than about a
dollar. It's more than that.
Yes.
And that's what I want to get into, because mm-hmm. I think that's not the piece of it you're pushing. You're not pushing that. That isn't what you want.
No. When I'm pushing pretty much, first of all, I am a descendant of slave. My father, my mother, my grandparent, and including myself, 13 years before I ran away from home, all those years I worked free and didn't even get paid. Yeah. So I'm a living product of that.
What were you doing?
Well, we pick cotton, mm-hmm. and we bale hay, and we pull corn, and those type of things there. But we did not pay not one penny. So reparation and descendant of slave, now I acted not only just saying, talking about it, I live it, all right? And then so it's like a lot of meaning to me because of those particular things.
Okay.
Now, the people now who's my age, I'm not looking for it for myself now, okay? But what about the people at my age? I'm 71. But the people who don't have any welfare, no pension, living on the street, don't have nothing to look forward for education-wise, because I only got to this school like 2 months out of a year. So it varies personal to me. We believe that reparations descendant of slave, just like they did in Japan. In 2016...
For the Japanese internment camps,
Japanese,
people
right.
who were in camp during the war.
Uh-huh. At the Native America. And even with Sanctuary City in 2016, I believe nationwide it was like $57 billion mm-hmm. that went to Sanctuary City. Now, I'm not knocking any of that, but I'm saying, look, we have some right in Chicago right now. Crime is high. Education, no school, no trade, no nothing. Two generations of African-American descendants of slavery have been washed out. And we got to do something about it. Training, you know. And get schools
well,
open.
Let's talk about that piece of it, because mm-hmm. I think that's what you're saying. You're saying that there are reparations in the form of creating more opportunities for minorities, and particularly African Americans. That's the piece of it that you would like to see more equitable. Is that where you're,
well,
where you're
well,
going with this?
Well, yeah. I introduced a bill. First of all, we introduced it. I had the bill paid for. I paid $10,000 for the lawyer to write this bill. We're giving it to a alderman, I won't call it a name, to present it to the city council, but it's in committee, haven't gotten out yet. So that don't seem to work right now. So going to the state, Representative Will David is going to introduce it to the state in February in the committee. Also, Senator Matty Hunter is going to do it as well. It is a national issue, but I'm starting local for myself.
What right. you do, you see the Democratic candidates, they've all been asked about it on stage.
That's
during
correct.
The debates. A mm-hmm. lot of the Democrats do agree with it. Bernie Sanders, though not as on board as the others, he just thinks it would be divisive mm-hmm. and that it wouldn't get through Congress. They do seem to all agree on setting up a commission to study reparations to see what can be done. Senator Klobuchar said she believes we need to invest in those communities that have been hurt by racism
mm-hmm.
and hurt by generations of lack of opportunity. But she says to have a direct pay for each person is not what she would necessarily advocate, but she invest in those communities. Are you most in agreement with her?
Well, look, mine's is this, to be clear on this here. It's going to take some money, yes, all right? But I'm more interested in long terms, the education piece of it, the trade piece of it, the opportunity, like when you pay taxes, we get less than 0.5% contracts, equality, back to African-American descendant of slavery. You're going the education of the school. How can a person pay $40,000 for a good education when they live in probably making $15,000.
But aren't there programs to help low-income people at most colleges and universities? We just had the chancellor of the University of Illinois in studio yesterday, and he mm-hmm. was talking about now if you make up to $67,000, and it's gone up, is a household income, you go to University of Illinois for free. And there are other programs like that. You have the city government has contracts where there are opportunities for women and minorities only to bid, and that there's a certain percentage that should go to them. Aren't these things already in place, or would you want to go farther?
Well, they may be in place, but they're not being acted upon. If the universe was that good, and that what they say, if the city of Chicago was that good, saying what they say, why our neighborhood don't have economic development and ownership in it? If I drive right now from downtown up on Clark Street, all the way as far as I can go, stores, you know, businesses. Mm-hmm. But if I go west,
right,
you know, beyond the stadium, or if I go south, it ain't nothing there. So I'm not just talking about just talk. Yeah, you know, look, leave people
economic
talking.
Investment.
You'd yes, like to- mm-hmm. yes. And you're going to need some dollars now. Back in France and all these kind of different places, when people get reparation, I think one place I was reading the other day, they got $300 billion in gold, plus build the city up. All right? So look, if you're going to do it for, here again, I got to come back to Sanctuary City. $57 billion here in 2016 around the country in Sanctuary City. You got more of a Sanctuary City right here that people going in jail, misdemeanor, nonviolent. People been in jail for 2 or 3 years and ain't got $100 to get out.
Mm-hmm.
Now privatizing prison, things of that nature as well. We got to do something about it.
I guess we just have to understand a little more about what's in your bill and what reparations really are, because we hear from Mayor Lightfoot even about how equity is a big piece of what she's trying to do for the city, that she says that I don't want every kid to have to beat the odds like I did in order to come from where I did and have lack of opportunities the way I did, but still manage to achieve in this world. So she thinks in Chicago there should be opportunities, and it feels as if that makes a lot of sense. It seems when you start taking it down several notches, it's like your chances of getting something like this passed become harder to do.
Well, I think it's a matter of being real about it. I mean, I look at the city of Chicago and the state of Illinois. Just give me this example here. We were locked up in jail for marijuana. Now they passed the bill. I mean, get it passed, all right? Mm-hmm. For marijuana. No African-American even own one yet, all right? So
it's true.
So what are they talking about? But if they can get the bill passed for paying taxes, gasoline, all this kind of thing to get things done, surely you can get this passed. Ain't but about 5 or 6 neighborhood in Chicago. It's really, really below property. You can make that investment.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say that they're just talking a lot of talk and not real, you know?
Yeah. Who do you like in the Democratic side, by the way? We're going to shift to politics here for a second.
Right,
Dr. Willie Wilson,
mm-hmm.
you ran for a number of offices. Mm-hmm. You ran for president. You ran for mayor mm-hmm. of the city of Chicago several times. You're currently running for U.S. Senate as an independent against Senator
yeah,
Durbin.
Yeah.
Who do you like on the amongst the Democrats for 2020 president?
I got to be honest with you. I'm still having a problem trying to figure out what's what on both sides. That is, all right?
Mm-hmm.
I think you got to talk about all citizens and not leaving one particular person out. You know, I think when people talk reparation, all right, they got to do more than that. They got to look back at their past, what they have done mm-hmm. with that.
That's important.
Yeah. I think that would be real. I haven't got nobody to figure out yet, but that's why I'm running independent. I would never be a Republican or Democrat again in my life.
Why is that?
Look, I ran for president. Okay,
as a Democrat, you ran for mayor.
Yeah. But when I ran for president, if we talk about that subject in 2016,
mm-hmm.
they wouldn't even allow me to get on a ballot in the state of Mississippi. But it took a white Supreme Court to make them put me on the ballot.
Mm, I remember that.
South Carolina was the same thing. You know, I couldn't get on the stage there. So I said, you're talking about slavery. Boy, and I took my son with me to see it. And he said, Dad, is this real? I said, that's why I brought you on the trail.
Right. It's more behind the scenes, I guess.
It's behind the scenes.
Because most people wouldn't know it would be that hard to get on the ballot unless you had gone through some sort of process like you did.
I went through the process. I spent a lot of money. In Iowa, for example. In the state of Iowa, they wouldn't even put my name on a ballot.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think that we have to be real, and we got to help all citizens go make this whole city and the country a much more better place.
Well, you are a business hero. We all know that. I mean, to think where you started as a custodian, basically, at McDonald's.
Yes.
Grew your business. You got your own McDonald's after a chance meeting with Ray Kroc.
That's correct.
To build that up, mm-hmm. and then you had a chain of McDonald's. Then you went over and you started your supply company with medical gloves,
mm-hmm.
and now you've got the face masks.
That
people are wearing in all the airports now.
Well,
and that seems like another profitable side of a business.
We sell a lot of those now.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
but
Walmart just picked up a big contract. Isn't that what happened?
Well, yeah. But what we do is this year, though, we take the money we make and pour it all back into the community.
I know you're very generous. Yeah. We've seen that. That's well documented. And I remember you had to fight other politicians about that,
yes.
too, when you were giving some people who needed some money. And that was very controversial, even though we see that all the time in government, but it's usually behind closed doors.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Willie Wilson. I hope you come back and talk to us again, and thanks for giving us your perspective.
Hey, thank you.
Always good to see you. The news is coming up next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. And then we've got 2 at 2, Family Matters. 2 experts, both clinical psychologists, weigh in on some family issues coming up. Just after 2 here on WGN Radio, this is Anna DeVlantis. Thanks for joining us. Family Matters is what we're talking about here at 2 o'clock. 2 at 2, 2 experts, both clinical psychologists, weighing in on some issues regarding families and marriage and couples and relationships and all that kind of stuff here with us. Happy that you guys are both here. Dr. Alexandra Solomon, she's a licensed clinical psychologist at the Family Institute, Northwestern University. She teaches one of the most popular classes at NU. It's Marriage 101. We're going to get to that in a minute. And also Dr. Adia Gooden, she's a staff clinical psychologist at Northwestern and director of community programs. Go Cats! Hey! Fellow grad myself, but this is pretty cool to have both of you here. You know, a lot of things, a lot of headlines that always make you sort of think and try to absorb, like, what is that, or maybe you relate to it and you say something like that is affecting my family. This is interesting. I saw this. Roasting your partner every day can help make your relationship stronger. A new study. I want to get you both to weigh in on this, because I would think if you're kind of roasting your partner, that could be taken a lot of different ways. What they found, though, is if you're sort of ribbing them about fun things or roasting them about little quirks, but in an affectionate way, I guess, it can help a relationship. You agree with this? What do you think?
Yeah, I thought this was, it really resonated with what we see in our practice, which, you know, the big, when we're sitting with a couple, the big thing we're trying to do is do more of the positive, do less of the negative.
But isn't that a negative when you say, oh, you're always snoring, and you're like, you know, like making fun of it or something? I mean, isn't that what roasting is? Or is it because it's playful? It's okay.
Well, I think it is. It's all in the context, right? And so, yeah, if I find it funny and you find it hurtful, then it is off the table. Right? It has to be determined contextually. It doesn't matter if I think it's hilarious. If it hurts you, it is going to erode trust and connection.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think if it's coming from a playful place, it often has the tone of, I love you and you do this and I still love you and I'm not going to get away from you just because you snore, just because you do this or that, right? So it has a way of connecting couples, even though it can be a little bit of this is the thing I put up with you.
I love you for the good things and I love you for everything, right? I mean, it's just sort of an act of love. I guess it can go too far, right? And I'm sure that you can voice that, right? If you keep going after someone for their snoring, for example, and you're your significant other, and you say, hey, okay, that's enough, right? That's enough.
Yeah, and here's what I think about is that in my own relationship, if my husband teases me, a tease might land really well on one day, and the same tease might land poorly on a different day. What it depends on is how I've been talking to myself all day. If I'm in a place of compassion with myself and I'm feeling comfortable in my own skin, I'm more likely to receive his playfulness in a gentle way than if I've been really hard on myself and I'm feeling self-critical, then I probably have a bit of a thinner skin.
That's so hard to do, though, isn't it? To know, I guess, you to read exactly where they are, right?
Yeah.
That's what makes it so complicated to be in a relationship.
Right. I also think it sort of depends on where the relationship is. I think about the fact that my fiance often teases me because I kick him in the middle of the night accidentally. Hopefully
oh,
not
accidentally.
Too hard. Yes,
yeah, because he's taken over too much of the space. Get over there. Move on.
So he often says it, and I experience it positively, right? Because I experience it as he likes sleeping with me, he likes being in the bed with me, but this is a little quirk that he has to put up with, right? I've also had a partner in the past who recorded me snoring and then played it back for me in a way that felt very critical and malicious and harsh. And it did not feel like positive teasing. It felt like, look at how you are. You are bad and wrong. And that didn't feel good at all.
I did it to my husband because he didn't believe that he snored as bad as he did snore. And it's pretty bad sometimes. So I did. And he did not like it either. He realized it was not great. He's like, oh, come on. That's just one night. It doesn't always sound like that.
Oh.
He took it very hard. So I'm like, you know, it's okay. As long as I can fall asleep, I can sleep through anything except, you know, when I wake up and someone's snoring, it's so hard to get back to sleep. That was so, we worked through that. You guys would both be very happy and proud.
Yeah, right. Well, snoring is a hard one because it's not under your conscious control. Mm-hmm. It's a tough one.
Because that's what, when you teach Marriage 101 in this class at Northwestern, that is one of the most popular, which I guess I want to understand why that is. It's the most popular, one of the most popular classes. People know this to be such a popular class. Why do you think that is?
Well, in part, it's because we've been doing it for so many years. So this is the 20-year anniversary this spring of Marriage 101.
Wow, congrats. So,
yes, I was basically pretty close to my students' age when we first started the class, and now I'm pretty close to their parents' age. So it's been awesome. Beautiful. You know, it's been part of my whole career, and it's really special. And I think that we are, you know, we're teed up to bring students in because we're talking about love and sex and dating and family and how we learn what we learn about love and our families growing up. So there's a real ripeness, you know, for emerging adults to understand where they have come from so that they can make choices that feel really good to them. So, and we work hard. We really take a lot of care with the students and make sure that their journey through the class is one where they feel supported because it's challenging to look at patterns, to look at beliefs, to figure out who you are and why you are the way you are.
Mm-hmm. So many of them are so far away from marriage. I guess that's why I was confused by why it's so popular. But you're right. It explores relationships. And that is extremely important and extremely interesting because no one really gets that perfectly right, right? Let's admit it.
That's right. Right.
Jessica Simpson in the news. I want to ask you about this because she gave this tell-all. She has a memoir. She's only 39, but she has a memoir. And some stories to tell that I think have sort of surprised a lot of people that are relatable in a lot of families. So she shared that she battled addiction. She called herself a high-performing addict that no one knew. She built this multi-million dollar clothing and shoe company, and she's just, you know, really cranking it on the business front and looked like this image of success. She was a mom, she was a wife, she's, you know, she had all this going on, and yet she said that she was an alcoholic and no one knew. And that it took, it was kind of dealing with life stress, which is something pretty relatable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You must see people who deal with this all the time. I mean, they're not Jessica Simpson level success, perhaps, but just the stress of daily life can drive people to make choices like this.
Certainly. I mean, I think often people don't know how to manage the challenging emotions that arise in daily life in a healthy way, right? The anger, the frustration, the disappointment, the feelings of shame. And it's pretty common for people to turn to substances. Alcohol is a very common one in order to manage that. I was reading the New York Times article about her memoir, and one of the things they talked about was the fact that she started drinking partly in response to one of her relationships and feeling inadequate, feeling like she didn't measure up, and using alcohol to just calm down. And we see that so commonly. I see that so commonly in therapy, people feeling like they're not worthy, feeling anxious, and trying to sort of cover over it all and manage how they're feeling with alcohol and not really feeling like they can show up as their full selves or get the help they need to live a full life.
Do you find that it's some people who are high performing and totally wouldn't know and they just sort of carry on and really keep it a secret for a long time, which is what she did?
I was listening to watching the interview from the Today Show, and they shared an image from Halloween a couple of years ago, and she was saying, you know, I was drunk by 7 a.m. on that day. Wow. But if you were to look at this picture, you would think I showed up for my family that day and that we were really playful and connected. And she said, and we weren't. I was drunk all day long. I have no idea how the kids got cared for. And that she was really highlighting that real split between what was happening on her insides, as Adia is saying, about the shame and the inadequacy, and then what we all saw on the outside that was really amplified by the persona, right? And when there's that split, shame really just fills in.
Right. And when you think, if you looked at her Instagram for that day, it probably would have looked like this perfect airbrushed family, you know, just everything's cool and kosher. And she's, you know, dealing with some very different reality, which I think is totally relatable for a lot of families. I want to ask you for some advice coming up just a second here about people who are dealing with addiction in their families and when you're helpful and when you're not, some kinds of things that can help. I think that'd be supremely helpful advice for a lot of folks. So let's get to that with our two clinical psychologists, Dr. Alexandra Solomon and also Dr. Adia Gooden, both from Northwestern. Go Cats. We're back in a moment. talking family issues, relationship issues with Dr. Alexandra Solomon. She's a licensed clinical psychologist at the Family Institute, Northwestern University. Her new book is called Taking Sexy Back. And Dr. Adia Gooden, also at Northwestern, staff clinical psychologist and director of community programs. We were mentioning we want to get to the issue of restoring a relationship trust after cheating, which is huge issue for a lot of couples, a lot of people in relationships. But first, I want to just continue with what we were saying about Jessica Simpson and this memoir that she put out. She talked about addiction, a hidden addiction, called herself a high-performing addict. No one knew. She finally got up the courage to say, hey, got to stop this. Talked to her husband, who was also drinking, I believe, and said, we both got to stop this. And I guess that was the first step. But you know, do you have some kinds of advice for people? Because addiction is such a common thing, whether it's alcohol or drugs or you name it. You have some common advice for people if you're a family member of someone dealing with this, what to do, what not to do? What do you see with your client?
One thing that's really important right off the bat is to say that addiction is a systems illness. So when there's a member of a family who is sick, the system is sick, meaning that the system will step in to fill the gap that the addiction is creating. So there's oftentimes patterns of enabling and overfunctioning, covering up for the person who's struggling, and that can feel like it's loving, and I think it is definitely loving when somebody's suffering to do for them, but it oftentimes just keeps the addiction, the sort of cycle going. And so oftentimes in the story of recovery, there is that moment when the system steps in and says, we love you way, way, way too much to allow this to continue, and we're with you. And then the journey of healing needs to be the person with the addictions process and the system's process. The system also needs to heal.
So, Dr. Dia, do you deal with the families as well as the person who's going through this? I imagine that's part of the solution, right?
Yeah, I completely agree. There have often in these relationship dynamics, whether it's family or, you know, romantic relationship, there have been patterns of behavior where, you know, people might call it codependence, but, you know, the partner with the addiction has been sort of supported by the partner without it. And there's something mutually sort of keeping that dynamic locked in. And so for family members who are caring for a person with addiction, one thing is to, you know, when this process starts, look at yourself, right? Look at yourself and how this dynamic has maybe felt comfortable, maybe sort of helped you to show up in a way that feels good as a savior or a hero in the relationship, right? So start to do your own work around that while also supporting your partner or family member in a way that's really not shaming, right? That's often people with addiction carry a huge amount of shame. And so feeling like they're being judged or shamed by a family member may not help them to get help or treatment. It may cause them to go deeper into the addiction. So wanting to sort of talk to family members and get them help in a way that's really accepting and loving and encouraging and communicates that, you know, no matter what you're dealing with or you're troubled by, I'm going to be here with mm-hmm. you, helping you.
Do you call it out? If you think, like, so let's say you're friends with Jessica or somebody in your own family, and you're like, wait a minute, something's not right here. Mm-hmm. I think that there may be an addiction here. I mean, what's the right way to just approach that?
I think couched in love, like, I love you so much that I want to speak truth to you. And sometimes it is, as Adia is saying, like, making sure you've done your own work on your side of the street so that when you do speak, because you may feel angry, right? People who love those who are addicted can feel angry and disappointed. And so we want to take responsibility for our anger, have places where we are getting support for that so that when the conversation happens, the love really comes through. And there are clinicians who specialize in just getting a family system ready to do an intervention.
Okay, there is a, I want to speak, you mentioned shaming and that sometimes addicts can feel shame. There's shaming in so many different ways. In the Chicago Tribune today, there, Amy Dickinson, dear Amy, addressed this issue of fat shaming, a mother worried about fat shaming her son. And she talked about how I'm making him log his calories on a website to be aware that beef brisket has a ton more calories than fish. I'm having him run up the stairs and do 2 minutes of cardio every whatever, however often, she doesn't say. I'm teaching him not to just sit around. I have this bad, looming, horrible, guilty feeling about this health education because of how my parents treated me. Is it okay to do this kind of thing? He seems okay with it. But it's what point is it like, okay, wait, this is a little too much. It does feel like that way to me. What do you both think? Dr. Adia, do you have any thoughts about how you tell people to deal with, if you have a kid who's overweight or not eating healthy, that this is this seems like it goes a little too far?
Yeah, and you know, I think the interesting thing is that, you know, often when families come into therapy, if parents are bringing in a child that they're concerned about, parents have a hard time recognizing that they're contributing to the challenges their child has, right? And so it would be important for parents to think about, you know, what have I been communicating about relationship with food? What types of food have I been providing? Is it nourishing for my child to get them to a point where I may be concerned about their health? I think if a parent is trying to support their child in being healthy, that really needs to be the focus and not weight. Because whenever we're sort of calling certain foods bad or, you know, shaming somebody for their weight, especially a child, we're setting up a really problematic relationship that that person is going to have with food when they get older. And so if you want to get a health coach or a nutrition coach, it may make sense to outsource that and not have it be a parent and make sure you're vetting that person and make sure they're focused on health and whole health and not
weight,
know.
Diet, yeah, making
exactly.
kind of saying, looking at your body, right, and saying that that's not right, I guess. Yeah.
The two red flags that I hear really loud and clear, the first one is the language of I'm making him. Mm-hmm. I'm making him climb stairs. I'm making him do this. And whenever we get into that language of like, how do I get my kid to, or I'm making my kid, we know there's some stir within us as the parent that we need to take responsibility for. And she did a nice job of kind of highlighting that second red flag, which is she said, I'm scared I'm doing to my son what my parents did to me. And so right there is the entry point into her own journey around what part of her is unhealed that's being activated right now when she looks at her son. What is he mirroring back to her? And so she may be trying to heal something within herself through her son, but that's hers. That's her journey. And so I want her getting support around. It's incredibly triggering to have a child, and our children do a very fine job of mirroring back to us, you know, our tender spots. But it's our job as parents to take responsibility for our tender spot rather than doing what she's aware that she's doing, which is she's just creating. She's passing down through the family tree what was given to her.
Speaking of mirroring, my daughter, my 8-year-old wants a phone right now. It's like I'm not ready to have a phone, but she sees everybody else on the phone, so she wants a phone. That's a long conversation that I have regularly. We got to get to this because we talked about it. Restoring trust after cheating in a relationship, something so hard to do, so many couples face. It's constantly something people struggle with all the time. What's your advice on that, Dr. Adia?
So it is really challenging. I think a big piece is patience. Patience for both partners. So there's, you know, a number of processes that need to happen. First, the person who had an affair needs to end the affair, right? So we cannot restore trust if the affair is still going on. They need to apologize for it, right? Sincerely apologize and acknowledge that what they did was hurtful and a betrayal of the boundaries of the relationship. And then, you know, there's a process of rebuilding trust, which looks like over communicating where you're going, what you're doing, right? And that's a temporary thing, but it's important to rebuild trust if you had been lying about where you were going, who you were talking to, what you're doing. Now we need to over communicate, right? To rebuild the trust that you are where you say you are. And then sort of later down the line, there's an examination of what were the dynamics in the relationship from both partners that led the affair to happen. Mm-hmm. Because the affair is one outcome, but usually it does not come out of nowhere. Usually there's an ongoing dynamic in the relationship that was challenging and problematic that both partners contributed to that sort of set up the situation for that.
Yeah, it's interesting. There are all these, this is what I find fascinating. There are all these apps now to try to help happier couple. So you either like, you nudge each other during the day. It reminds you to tell your partner, hey, remind them that you love them. Remind them that you like this about them or that about them. I feel like sometimes the technology gets in the way of what could just be human contact. But okay, I mean, I guess, do you hear from people about these apps that they actually work? There's one that talks about sharing housework. There's another about reminding them to, you know, be intimate. There's ones about fix a fight. That's actually an app. It suggests ways to partners to express themselves in a way that gets the problem solved without any arguments. Do you like the sound of that, Dr. Alexandra?
Well, what I do, I like the idea, if we're using this app as a tool that gets us from point A to point B, and point A is we're disconnected, and point B is we're connected. And connected really has to be like old school, farm to table, face to face. I'm looking in your eyes, you're looking at my eyes, you know, my foot touches your foot while we're having this hard conversation. Like, we're mammals. We need those like five sensory cues that you're on my team and I'm on your team. So if the app becomes a starting point mm-hmm. of something that then we're able to somehow more easily transition to something where there's touch and vision and communication and voice, then I'm all for it. But you're right. I think what I want couples to be mindful of is it replacing or is it a gateway towards mm-hmm. connection?
Dr. Dia, do you have any thoughts about these? I mean, most of the psychologists I've ever asked about this, and there have been two on the show, they said they really don't like this stuff. They don't like when you get like advice from an app because they feel as if it's just sort of technology, and maybe they don't love it.
Yeah, I think, you know, I agree with Dr. Solomon. You know, it's the challenge is if people think that you just can go through these motions or behaviors and your relationship will be good. And what we know from doing couples therapy is that something deeper usually needs to happen, right? If a couple comes in with communication problems, it's usually not as simple as just, okay, well, when that person talks, you listen. And when you talk, they listen, right? Usually you have to work on some deeper issue and some deeper disconnect. And so what's important is for couples to know that they can use these tools, but not forget to nourish the deep mm-hmm. foundation of their partnership.
A little face to face.
Exactly.
Can be helpful for sure. We have 630. My wife had an affair. She wouldn't do any of the things that you just described. She just wanted to think our marriage would be stronger because she had an affair. You notice I said ex-wife. So that's how things sometimes end up. Yes. Well, we appreciate the advice. We appreciate you both being here, both clinical psychologists, Dr. Alexandra Solomon. Get her book, Taking Sexy Back, How to Own Your Sexuality and Create the Relationships You Want. Check that out. And Dr. Adia Gooden, also a staff clinical psychologist at Northwestern. Thank you both. Appreciate it. Appreciate you lending your perspective to these issues today.
Thanks so much.
Coming up here?
Yeah,
absolutely. Coming up here on WGN Radio, we've got a pediatric surgeon here to tell us about how she's helping make the world a better place. She's going to tell you about it. Actually, a group of Chicago area doctors are doing something really cool. We're going to tell you about it coming up here on the show. 2:32 is the time here in the Skyline studio. This is Anna DeVlantis. We're here with a pediatric surgeon, two very special guests, actually, and an event going on here in Chicago to support some amazing work that they are doing. We're going to get that in a second. We have a couple of coronavirus things. I know Steve's been talking about it in the news. You have the woman who was infected, who was the subject of that news conference about a week or so ago. Now her husband has been infected, the first person-to-person spread of coronavirus in the United States. Then you have that Wisconsin dad who's trying to bring his wife and two young daughters, a 10-month-old and a 5-year-old, back from the Wuhan province. He's having some difficulty. He's a Milwaukee guy, and his wife is from that area. They landed there to celebrate the Lunar New Year with some family, and then a couple of hours later, well, they basically locked down the area, so he could not come back. He's waiting for a charter jet to get out of that area, but it hasn't happened yet, so he's still waiting. And then you have that cruise ship held on the Italian cruise ship as passengers are sort of being kept there because they believe they have a confirmed case there off the coast of Italy of somebody on that particular cruise ship. So it's, you know, a lot of efforts made to be containing the coronavirus. That is the object here, of course, and it's happening here in Chicago, and I feel like health officials are doing a darn good job at it right here. Dr. Ami Shaw is here. She's a pediatric surgeon, and she's doing a real cool thing, along with a friend of hers, Thomas Purden. There's an event here. We're going to get to more on that. Dr. Ami, thanks for being here. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate your time and having me on the show.
When you hear about the coronavirus, it feels as if health officials are, from my perspective, it feels as if that they're doing a very good job. The issue here is always containment and trying to just understand where the cases are and that kind of thing. Do you feel as if so far that things are being handled pretty well? Come a little closer to the microphone.
We can't hear you. I think everyone's doing a great job with the taking care of the coronavirus. They've been right on top of everything, and they've been closely monitoring all the contacts. One of the hospitals I also operate at is St. Alexius, where they have the confirmed
one of the cases.
Yep. And they've really been on top of making sure everyone's being appropriately screened and all the precautions of being taken.
Yeah, it does. It does feel that way. And we have to remind people every time we talk about it that your chances of getting the flu much, much greater. You see far more cases of flu.
And it's killed, and the flu's killed way more people this year than the coronavirus has yet.
Yeah, I think flu season is already over 8,000 people. So it just puts it in perspective. I know that these stories, the issue I think there is just the containment, and that's where I feel like health officials have been really on top of it. And from my perspective, and it feels very good. But we want to talk about what you're involved with. That's why you're here. It's an organization called Operation International, and it was started by surgeons. There are a bunch of doctors here in the Chicago area who are doing some pretty cool things. Dr. Ami, if you will just tell us, what are you guys doing?
Yeah, I'm really excited. So in May, we're going to Uganda to operate basically for a week for people who need healthcare. There's a great hospital there that's only staffed by 4 doctors for about 1 million people. And
1 million people, 4 doctors.
Mm-hmm. And
where is that?
It's in Rakai, Uganda. Mm-hmm. And it's the sort of southern portion of Uganda. And there's so Operation International has set up a relationship with this hospital where a different chapter from around the world comes about every 3 months to operate on people who need operations. And it's the entire variety of operations. Our group includes some general surgeons, a plastic surgeon, and then, of course, me as the pediatric surgeon.
Mm-hmm. So you go and you see what the needs are, and you volunteer your time completely free. You donate everything.
Mm-hmm.
Your time, and then you go there and you see what the needs are in this underserved community and take care of things. What have you seen and witnessed in the past? Give us a sense for what that might look like.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's a lot of things that here in the United States we wouldn't even worry about. It would be that easy things to get taken care of, but they get just so far, these conditions just go untreated for so long that they become very serious. There's a lot of burn contractures, unfortunately, from accidents.
Mm.
That's our plastic surgeon. There's a lot of deformities from, industrial accidents and farming accidents that they just were not able to get treated in time. Lots of children with hernias, which you don't think are big deals, but they just don't get fixed. So they become very large and the kids aren't able to walk.
Oh, my gosh.
And so lots of people with thyroid problems who get huge thyroids so they can't breathe well, they can't lay flat. So lots of things that would hopefully never happen in the United States.
Yeah, you would hope not. It's certainly not at that particular level of that many people being impacted by things like that that seem like they are pretty routine, but if you left untreated, it's a real problem. You also do things where you bring things for the orphanages in the area. That's part of what you do. Even members of your group have built dorms for the children. It seems like a lot of really amazing things you're doing to try to transform people's lives.
Yeah, it's really exciting. Especially the New York chapter has been really great about involving other people and other ways in which you can get involved. And actually, if you go on the website, there's a contest that if you repost Operation International on your social media, you could come help us as well. There's always lots of work to do. But there is an orphanage there that we are supporting, and they used to sleep 6 kids to a twin bed, and last time they were able to build dorms so that each child could have their own bed.
6 kids in one twin bed. So mm-hmm. How old were the kids?
Anywhere from infants to teenagers, and they just, because of a lot of accidents, people dying from yellow fever, typhoid, malaria, HIV, a lot of these kids are abandoned, and they have nowhere else to go, and so they're just sort of dropped off at the orphanages, the lucky ones are.
Yeah.
And so this time when we're going in May, we're going to drop plans to make a school for hopefully 500 children.
Wow. So if people have any kind of, carpentry skills or building skills and that kind of thing, can they join forces with Operation International?
Absolutely. They go to the website and they can put in their information. I'm sure we can find a way to use their skills.
So it isn't just doctors, it's people who might have some sort of other supportive skills
that go with you, or is it typically?
It's typically doctors, but occasionally we do have other people come with us as well, mm-hmm. To help those plans, and then we go back in other times and build those orphanages.
Wow. Well, let's talk about the event, because this is the thing you're here to promote, and hopefully people can support your mission to provide free medical care and help others in the way that you're doing, in this tremendous way. It's been around how long, Operation International?
The original founders out of New York, they've been doing this for over 20 years.
Wow. Okay. And the Chicago group, how long have you all been associated with it?
This is our inaugural mission. We're really excited about it. In the group of people that are going now, one of the other surgeons has gone on a couple mission trips with Operation International. Mm-hmm. And this is the first time we're starting a Chicago chapter. So,
wow. Well, we wish you luck with everything you do, and thank you for doing what you're doing. What is the event? So tell us more about it. Is it tomorrow night?
It's actually February 29th.
Oh, it's next. Okay. Yes. I thought it was the 29th. Yeah. I was like, wait, when is the 29th? It's February 29th. Okay.
Because
there is a 29th in the February of next month. Okay.
Right. Yep. It's leap day. So we thought it would be a good day that would be easy to remember. It's from 6 to 10 p.m. at 2105 West Division.
2105 West Division. What's that business?
It's actually just an event space that was kind enough to donate some hours to us for free.
Okay.
And then
I like that. Very lean organization, yeah, sounds like.
Well, because all our money goes towards buying supplies and getting there and setting up everything we can. There's no one, everybody that's part of the organization, no one draws a salary. Everything's for free. All the money we raise is for travel and for supplies. We're lucky to have Oxblood and More that are going to be.
Oxblood and More. That's the band that's going to play. And that's you, Thomas. So you heard about what they're doing. You're like, hey, I gotta help out. Is that what happened?
Yeah. So Ami reached out to us and asked, and we were just happy to be able to be a part of something that's a cause that's so great. And we're able to happily donate our time and our music, and hopefully we can get some people out there.
So did you know each other, or did you just find out about the organization first?
No, through family.
Through other people. Oh, yeah. Well, cool of you to help out with that. And that. So there's going to be a band, and it'll be...
There'll be drinks. There'll be fun.
How much is it?
It's $50 a ticket, and the event's from 6 to 10 p.m., and you can find it on our Facebook site, Operation International Team Chicago. It's on Eventbrite, so...
Okay. Well, check it out and help out a good cause. This is a really cool event. It's not until end of February. Correct. February 29th. Yes, there is one this year, and it's happening that night, so it'll be easy to remember for sure. Dr. Ami Shah and Thomas Purdon, thank you for doing what you're doing and sharing it with us and our listeners. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Good to see you guys coming up here on WGN Radio. We've got trending topics, and this is interesting, including the bar that thought it was a good idea to offer deals on Coronas to capitalize on the coronavirus. Yeah, people didn't love that. And then we have not to be outdone, the New York clothing company that figured out what represents Chicago, and what they said represents Chicago, the way they did it, the whole thing, is making Chicagoans sort of cringe, coming up here on WGN Radio. It's time for Trending Topics 2:45 here on WGN Radio. Lauren Lapka has stepped into the studio as we talk about the things people are liking and sharing and things that are trending across the Chicago area. How about this? Did you see this? A New York company thought it'd be a good idea to come up with ball caps that define different cities across the country, and they did one for Chicago. So they released a line of hats for Major League Baseball and National Basketball Association teams in select cities. The thing was called Team Describe, and it features designs meant to spark civic pride. So the Chicago hats for the Cubs, White Sox, and the Bulls feature, listen to this, the city flag in the front, okay, and then in the back, a big slice of deep dish pizza on your ball cap.
Really? That's the best they could come up with?
It's like, oh yeah, they like pizza, and it's deep dish there. It's not thin like it is in New York, right? So let's put that on a cap, and everyone's got like a sort of a... It just, yuck. It just isn't the right way. That's, come on.
Yeah, I don't really want to wear a slice of pizza on my head.
I know, it looks kind of weird. In the back of your head, you just got a slice of pizza.
Okay. I mean, A for effort?
Yeah, A for something, for trying.
Or a C for bad creativity.
Yes, I think it gets a C. That's not cool. People are not liking on that. Also, this is getting a fair amount of criticism and reaction of that sort. A bar decided that it'd be a good idea to capitalize on the coronavirus by doing a Corona beer promotion. $6.50 a Corona beer while the pandemic lasts was the ad that they posted everywhere.
I mean, the fact
and
that
then
they started
had a photo. Listen to this, Lauren. Before you weigh in, there's more. A photo of two men wearing hazmat suits and face masks accompanied the particular ad, and a lot of people said, you know, no,
they started with, let's capitalize on the coronavirus. You knew it was going to be bad, no matter what it was.
It's like, who does that, right? It's sort of, this actually goes all the way out of New Zealand, but they did post it on Facebook. They put it on social media. So it was tweeted and retweeted everywhere with people saying, can you believe what they're doing? You see these two guys in their full hazmat suits, their gas masks, and they're holding a Corona with the advertisement underneath. Oh, gee. They decided that it was insensitive, and they've since pulled the ad. So that's all worked out best for everyone. NIU, this is interesting. They're deciding that the Northern Illinois University, that is, deciding that no more standardized tests. You don't need a standardized test in order to get into their school there. They're minimizing the whole role of SATs and ACTs. They say you don't need them. They're going to do a grade point average based admittance. So that's what they decided to do.
I'm a big fan of that. I was a student that was always terrible at taking tests. Always. So it would never reflect really how decent of a student I was. I will say decent, not great, but decent. Because I just, you know, sometimes people are just better by showing.
Test taking.
Yeah, than they are by producing a test.
I heard someone say earlier that they were the opposite, that they were really good at tests mm-hmm. and then got all C's. And so how would that person fare on this test or to get in? And I guess those are the people that'll be upset with this. But they're just kind of saying if you have a 3.0 GPA, you are automatically accepted to the school. And then otherwise you have to go through the process. Mm-hmm. So if you have a C average, I suppose you could still potentially get in. There are other things that are emphasized, but they're definitely de-emphasizing the test score. And I think that's fascinating. I really do. I think it is.
Believe this or not, I went to Purdue, but I got a 22 on my ACT. Mm. 22. That's terrible.
And then how'd you do at Purdue? Because that's always...
You know, average. Again, mm-hmm. I was just an average student, mm-hmm. but it was a difficult school. But again, because tests do not reflect very well for me.
So your grade point average must have been...
It was up there.
It must have been up there, right? So I think that's a difficult school to get into, too. Mm-hmm. So they weight out everything and there are other factors.
Yeah, I was very happy about that.
Yeah, you're like, hey, well, that was good. So it worked out for you.
Yeah.
And I guess it'll work out for some people at NIU. They say the test score isn't going to matter so much. Listen to this out of Naperville. The Hearst story, they're seeking some personal stories from local women, nominations of standout females, because they're going to use them in museum media, exhibits, social media posts, public art pieces, and more. It's part of their Her Story campaign. Here's the deal. Naper Settlement President is saying, we are honored to be the storytellers and keepers of Naperville's history, past and present. Her Story is an opportunity to tell a story of amazing women in our community. So there you go. You just submit your 250-word entry, and or you can do a video, one-minute video, how you've made an impact in the community, and they may pick you. Celebrate you.
It's a little weird to do it for yourself, but maybe
it's like I'm making an impact, aren't I?
maybe someone else can sort of say,
will you make a video and submit it? Probably a better way to go about that, but who knows? They might find a gem that way who otherwise they wouldn't. The Popeye's chicken sandwich is back. We know that. Now they've announced they are going to up the sandwich wars and have pitted some of the largest fast food chains against each other with the debut of a fashion line. Did you see this?
What?
Popeye's fashion.
Okay, what
does that look like? A clothing line. It's based on the chain's employee uniforms. Limited edition. It always makes it sell better, right? Very limited edition. Did you get this one?
This is rare.
In fact,
get it while
so
you
rare,
can.
No one's buying it. 10 items ranging from a variety of hats costing about $10 to hooded jackets for upwards of $40. Kind of relaxed fit. They look kind of like sweats. And then there's the hats that look like just like your normal ball cap, but
is everything
got,
super orange probably?
Yes, very orange. There's a lot of orange. So they say they like the chicken sandwich, so popular. And what about the clothing that goes along with it?
I don't think that's why they're going there a lot.
It feels as if that's a brand extension that I'm not sure is going to be so successful, but who knows? You never know. I wonder where they sell it too. I got to figure that out, because that might be interesting. If you had it in the store, maybe you pick one up with your chicken sandwich if you can find one. Okay, the FDA is warning against Purell hand sanitizer, because it's got some claims on the packaging. The FDA is saying, U.S. Food and Drug Administration, that they can't back up. It says on Purell that they prevent disease from viruses like norovirus, influenza, the flu, or Ebola. And so the agency notified them of the violations and said they've got to take prompt action and correct them because it's they're saying, nope, you can't live up to that. And so you got to move it. Perel is saying we are very effective at handling all kinds of things and preventing. We're a great preventive measure for flu.
Yeah, but that's the problem because then you gotta. That's what you have to write. We're good at helping prevent. We can't just straight up do it, though.
Yes, exactly. I think the claims were a little too strong on the packaging, and so they've got to weaken those a little bit. The FDA got on them. Here we go. Nike has completely sold out of Kobe Bryant gear.
Oh,
yeah. How about that? Totally sold out. If you search on the website Nike for anything with Kobe keyword, Kobe Bryant. In memory, Mamba gear, it's all sold out. And as you know that, I guess that should be no surprise, but it shows you.
It's amazing to see the stuff that keeps pouring in. I saw a video of a high school basketball game yesterday of a kid scoring the game winner at the buzzer, and he was wearing number 24.
Oh, wow.
So everyone rushed the court, and they were like, for Kobe!
Yeah, and you saw UConn do that really cool tribute to his daughter. Mm-hmm. Yeah. She had hoped to go to UConn one day, and they left the empty chair with the flowers and a jersey there. I mean, it just, you know, it's pretty cool. Trader Joe's has had customers vote on their favorite products for many, many years, and they're out with the new list. Do you have a favorite product? Do you go to Trader Joe's?
Not really.
I was amazed by
the budget for Trader Joe's.
This list is pretty interesting because one of the things on it is one of my favorite things, the Everything But the Bagel seasoning blend.
Oh.
So they take like what's on a normal everything bagel and they sell it as a spice.
Oh, I'm a big fan.
It's so good. You pour it on like toast on top of butter or I put it on eggs. I just dip eggs in it. Yeah. It's like so good.
I didn't know that existed.
I know. You know what's funny? That's what drew my attention to this particular list because I thought that is something that I think is a wow item. I haven't seen anywhere else. And it's one of the things. I don't often go to Trader Joe's, but when I do, that's one of the things I pick up. Other favorites include their dark chocolate peanut butter cups, because I think they're more reasonable than the competing brands. And then unexpected cheddar and avocados, cauliflower gnocchi. That was out there. Yeah, okay. That's a big one. Mandarin orange chicken, another one. So there you go. I remember they had $2 Chuck. The wine was like $2.
I have heard
of that.
Probably
too young for that, but they used to have that, and that was a big deal. Japanese billionaire, we mentioned this story before, he was searching for a girlfriend to fly to space with him, and he offered people the chance to go to space with him. 27,000 women applied, nearly 30,000.
Wow.
He's a 44-year-old bachelor, and he said, you know, I'm going to do this whole thing. He was somehow affiliated with Elon Musk, and I always question everything that he's involved with, but he apparently put out the search, and now he says, I'm scrapping the whole thing. I'm just not doing it. It's that he's kind of feels like he was using up too much of their precious time, but he no longer is looking for a girlfriend to go on his trip to the moon aboard SpaceX with Elon Musk. So maybe it was all a big publicity stunt. I don't know.
Wasn't there supposed to be a TV show?
Yes, there was. You're right. He says, despite my genuine, honest determination toward doing the show, that's the show you're talking about. Part of me still had mixed feelings about my participation. Really?
Okay.
You didn't know that going in? Really? That's going to do it for Trending Topics. We're going to talk to Ro Khan coming up and also get a feeling for what's happening in the news from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.